I'm Georgie Crawford. You're listening to the Good Glow podcast. Throughout my treatment for breast cancer, I've realised the importance of self-care. Whether it's a trip to the gym, a checkup with your GP, or even a 5-minute pamper session, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. I'll speak to people who remind us to take better care of ourselves and people who will motivate us and inspire positive change. This podcast is made possible by Sally Hansen, the creator of which was an inspirational woman who promoted the message of self-care all the way back in the 1930s. Whether it's a quick tan application or a cuticle oil top-up, Sally Hansen wants us to have the power to feel like our best selves. This week on the Good Glow podcast, I talk to Riad Khalaf. When Riad was a teenager, he and his mum Lorraine hid his sexuality from his dad for 9 months before finally blurting it out one night. That night, Riad's dad locked himself away and has spoken openly about contemplating suicide. But since then, Riad's family have come together and they became the faces of Ireland's marriage referendum. They are stronger than ever and by telling their truth have saved lives. Riad and I also talk about the crazy days when we worked too hard and laughed even harder and why he eats broccoli for breakfast. I hope you enjoy. Riad, I am so thrilled to finally have you on the Good Glow. This has been a long time coming.
A long, long time. I mean, when I heard that you had launched the podcast and I had listened to our good friend Claire Solon on it while I was in the gym, crying, looking like a lunatic with the dumbbells, I thought, okay, I need to get home, even if it's just to sit with you and have a really deep, lovely, warm chat. Because I love you.
Oh, I love you.
I really
too. So obviously we worked together in Spin. We sat beside each other for a couple of years and
you're my boss.
Yeah, and we just laughed the whole time.
It was actually, to be honest, I look back now on the years that we had together in Spin as the happiest years of my life. Because it wasn't just going into work, it was going in to do something that we both loved. We had such a passion for that station and the brand and being broadcasters, but also I was surrounded by family. It was just laugh, laugh, laugh from morning till night in that building.
And I think it's because we all had the same dream. We all wanted to make great radio and we were all very supportive of each other. And we were young. We were young, yeah. And I think, well, this is what I think of you, Riad, that when you came to Spin, you kind of found your people.
Yeah.
And you could be your true self in there.
Well, this is what I always said about Spin as a station. It was a collection of all of those annoying kids in school who wouldn't shut up, who always thought that they were bloody hilarious, but weren't necessarily actually that funny.
Yeah.
But we kind of like lifted each other up and laughed at each other's crap jokes.
It was a very creative environment though, wasn't it? It wasn't just about radio. Like, we did so much behind the scenes videos and, well, you mostly created the videos and came up with the concepts for them and then we'd record them every day.
Do you remember the burger outlet video that we did?
Of course I do.
So Georgie and I, our jobs were basically to be the entertainment anchors of the station. So Georgie would do the morning and then I'd do the afternoon. And we were doing so much work. We were on air across two stations. We were doing the website for two stations, social media, while also, you know, running across town to the Aviva Stadium to do an interview with some gobshite. And then we would do this entertainment video every day. And so I would research what was the big sort of funny story of the day. And it was this burger outlet, which shall not be named, that launched a Black Bund burger. I don't know why, but they did, right? And the thing, there were these reports online of people in America that had gotten the burger before Ireland and they had gotten eaten it. And then the next day they had like cartoon green poo. The next day, like it was fluorescent. Do you remember this?
Yeah, I'll never forget it.
And then we realized after that this specific burger outlet had was planning to an advertising campaign on our very station. They had seen our video kind of lolling at their green poo burger and pulled the campaign. And your Jamie came up to me with tears in his eyes laughing, and I was thinking, this is it, I'm done for. The job is gone, you know, and it was the burger's fault. And he just said, I don't care. It was great content.
I nearly died laughing that day.
Oh, it was such a good day. But they thought that, how mad that that was our job.
Yeah.
We were being paid to just have a laugh. Yeah.
They were absolutely the good old days.
Good day, but also very stressful days.
Mm-hmm.
And I would see you, like, your hair was falling out before you had cancer because of how much you had on your plate. And you were not just my boss and kind of a mentor for me, but also, you know, a best friend. And I found it so hard that I couldn't actually support you. And I always did worry about your health, you know, because I rarely saw you fully relaxed.
Yeah. And that was my own fault.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I was the one that never took a break or never prioritized myself. And it's like when I look at photos of myself, even back then, like I look unrecognizable to myself.
In what way?
Physically.
Right.
My hair, like you said, very thin. I just looked wrecked.
Yeah. And I, like, I'm looking at you now and it's years later and you look younger.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Actually mad. Like, your skin is so bright and you haven't got a line on your face and you just, your eyes are like, you just look like a healthy person.
Oh, thanks, Riyad. And I put so much into my
health. Oh, I know. I see it online.
Every single day. And yeah, it does pay off. Let's talk about you and your life. And obviously, so many people listening to this podcast will be familiar. They may have seen you on The Late Late recently. Well, my personal favourite interview that you did was on Cutting Edge.
Oh, with Brendan O'Connor, yeah.
Yeah, and you spoke about your dad and coming out, and it was so moving. And you could literally hear a pin drop in that room. Tell us a little bit about your story and what it was like growing up for you.
Yeah, so for, you know, anyone who doesn't know, I grew up in a mixed household. So my mother is Irish, my father is from Iraq, and they're incredible, incredible parents that have always been very huggy, kissy and lovey. And I sort of realised that I was different, not gay, but different at about 12. My interests were different to other boys, and my kind of... just the way I was, the way I talked, the way I moved was different. And I recognized it. And then slowly but surely, other classmates began to kind of point out that I was weird and different. And you don't want to be weird as a kid. You just don't want to be the odd one out. So you just, you either stay silent, which I did for a while, or you become what I eventually became, which was the class clown. So for me, it was about, if I can make them laugh, then they're less likely to attack me.
Right.
If I can make them get shocked because I said something that I shouldn't say to a teacher, then at least I can deal with the teacher being angry at me because she's not going to physically attack me or say something that's really going to damage me on a deeper level. So I was always in trouble, but on purpose. I didn't want to be in trouble. I had to be in trouble to survive.
Wow.
And you didn't let people ever think about that. You know, like I at the age of 12, I had already figured out the little tricks that I could employ to just about cope the war zone that is school. Like, what 12-year-old should be figuring that stuff out? Well, you should be enjoying school, figuring out the changes in your body and making friends and hating that class and loving this class. But no, I was just coasting. I wasn't surviving. I wasn't living. And then it came to a point where I went through, I wrote a book recently and I talk about the PCO, which is the pre-coming out stage. And in that's the moment at which you realize that you are gay, this word that you've heard so much about, awful things about. And then you have to come to terms with it. That took me about 4 years without anyone else knowing. And I came out to friends in school and then I came out to mom. Well, I didn't come out to her. She found some sexy stuff on the family computer that I stupidly left open.
But did you know what gay was when you were 12?
I thought gay was that you had to dress up in drag and you had to be really funny all the time and really outrageous because the only exposure that I had to other gay person or people was Lily Savage.
Wow.
And if you're young and you're listening to this, Lily Savage is Paul O'Grady, the UK TV presenter in drag. He became famous by doing this drag act on TV years ago before gayness was even allowed. It was just, oh, but he's a funny gay. We'll allow him to be over there.
Mm.
And I thought, well, I that's not me. Like, I don't actually want to be that. Now, hilarious, years later, I ended up doing drag, but that was that's another story. There was no Graham Norton. There was no, you know, Queer Eye. There was no Love, Simon movie. Mm. There was no none of the stuff that I'm making now in my career that I could look to and go, oh, you can be gay and you can be a pilot. Oh, you can be gay and be a mechanic or whatever you want to be, or a doctor. It was like, I'm now limited and I can't chase my dreams. And what I have is an affliction and a sickness. And in the book and in life, I now say, it's not a sickness. This is not an affliction. It's a gift. You have been given this special thing and you need to hold it close and cherish it, because it's going to bring you community. It's going to bring you a superpower of empathy for other people, other minorities like you. And it's going to allow you to experience a sort of a subculture and a sect of society that is just bursting with love and pride.
Did you feel like denying it to your mum when she presented you with this?
I did. Briefly. So I might as well just say it while I'm here. The stuff that she found on the computer, Georgie, it was like so vanilla.
Okay.
It was like cute. Honestly, I typed in cute hunk topless. That's how, you know, things have changed since. But that was where we were at. And she was thinking, well, certainly not Sam, my dad. He's the most heterosexual person on planet Earth. My brother is a carbon copy of him. And she wasn't looking. So who's the last person? It's her little Riyadh, who loved nature and was a little softy.
But did she know?
She had a feeling, but she was kind of in denial and kind of just like, he's just my little Riyadh. That's just how he is. She didn't attach kind of the stereotypical gay traits to her little boy. It's just that's how he is. How could he possibly learn those things? That's just Riyadh. So then she came to me, and then I had my head in my hands on the table as she was saying, look, you can tell me anything. And if you've got something you need to tell me, it's okay. I'll still be here for you. I love you. And you can tell me you've murdered someone and I'm still here for you. That's literally what she said. And it took me about 2 hours to finally kind of say, I didn't say I'm gay. I said, I'm bi.
Okay. Was that an easier...
Yeah, and a lot of gay guys do that. Now, this isn't erasing bisexuality as an identity. It's very much a valid identity, and many people are bisexual for their entire lives. But for a lot of young gay and lesbian people coming of age, where they maybe aren't even fully sure of their attractions, they're still in the questioning phase, it's a sort of a safety net to say, I'm bisexual. Because you're not closing yourself off to anything then.
Mm.
And I actually did kind of still fancy girls in a way. But now looking back, I just idolized them. I'd look and go, God, isn't she so elegant? Look at her hair. Look at that dress. Oh my God, she's so pretty. But not like, I want to kiss her. I want to touch her. I want to be her boyfriend. It was, whereas, you know, the fellas, it was like, well, hormones were racing and I was just... Oh, like I'm sure you know, as a straight girl back in the day, like I would just look at, in particular, there's one boy, Sam Mulcahy, and I'm saying his full name because I need him to know that he actually allowed me to own my sexuality and begin to love it because I fancied him so much.
Wow.
And he didn't know. And I'd stare at him across the classroom. Anyway.
And so you kept then this secret from your dad for 7 months?
For 9 months.
9 months.
Yeah. And then mom was fantastic. She kept it in somehow, didn't tell him.
Did you beg her not to tell him?
Yeah, we made a pact. It was like, it was very, very strong. I knew that she wouldn't. It was so then we had a family argument, a typical teenage, you know, family argument. And then my mom just says, Riyadh, it's time to tell your dad something. And I was terrified of what his reaction would be because of his culture. He came from Iraq and was brought up as a Muslim. And that culture, you know, is generally anti anything that isn't straight. So I had sort of listed out all of the potential outcomes before telling him who I was, really. And that was anything from him giving me a hug and telling me everything's great and he knew, all the way down to honor killing me or getting someone to do it for him. And it sounds extreme and it sounds mad and out there that you'd even think of something like that in Ireland in modern day. But when you're so lost and so confused and unable to understand what someone's reaction will be, you kind of prepare for the worst.
Mm.
So naturally, in the 9 months of me kind of going over and over and over the 10 or 12 different outcomes, I began to hate him. And who this guy who was my best friend, my buddy, my confidant, the fellow I went fishing with every weekend, all of a sudden became this, you know, awful person that I didn't want to be around.
And he didn't understand why you were being kind of rude to him.
He just thought I was being a pissed off teenager.
So the night that you told him, he went to the, locked himself in the bathroom.
Well, my mom said, you need to tell your dad something, you need to tell your dad something. And I tried to physically make my mouth say the words, I'm gay. And they just, my mouth was, I've never since actually experienced it. It was a complete out of body experience. It was like I was looking in from above at me and my two parents there. And I was shouting at myself to say, I'm gay, just say it. And my jaw went into a complete lock. I couldn't actually speak. So then I pulled over a school book, ripped the back page out, wrote the words I'm gay and slid it across the table to him. And then he looked at me and looked at the paper, then looked back at me and said, okay, so everything will be okay, we'll fix this. And he meant that we are going to like make you straight in some way. Yeah.
So he went to the bathroom then and you
for
were...
For an hour, yeah.
Right. And what was he doing?
Thinking and panicking. And
trying to process
he was spinning and trying to sort of figure out how can this possibly be, was it his fault, was it something that, you know, they had lacked as parents, you know, that had caused me to be this way. So then we didn't speak that night much.
Did you feel better that night though?
Oh yeah.
Did you?
It was almost like, I know this is difficult for him, but I've been dealing with this for years and I am so ready to not care anymore. Can you imagine every day, every night, like sleepless nights in bed, panicking, and then finally, after all those years, you don't have to care about it anymore? It's like I was released from prison.
Oh my God, Riyadh.
It was like I was in prison and I was in a really, really bad one, alone. I was in solitary confinement. I wasn't even out having my outdoor playtime or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was like the worst kind because it's in your head. You're in your head. And then we didn't know this until ages after he told us that night when he went to, when we went to bed at about 4 o'clock in the morning, he woke up and he was looking for pills to commit suicide because of me.
And how did you feel when you found that out?
A mixture of everything. I felt, how dare you even consider this? What have I done? What? Tell me the bad thing that I've done to make you feel like this is your only way out. Get a grip. Pull yourself together, man, for God's sake. That's how I felt, right? Mm-hmm. That's me speaking from the heart now. Now, that's me back then. I don't feel that way anymore. I get it now. The other side felt very, very guilty that I was the catalyst to make someone think that the only way out was to take their life. And not just any person, my best friend, my buddy, my dad, my mentor. And what my thing is now is that I realize, and you know, I'm constantly telling young LGBT people this, is that, yeah, you've had all these years to come to terms with it and accept yourself and hate yourself for a while probably, and sort of finally go, I am proud. Those three words, right? When you tell a parent who you are and what your gender identity or sexuality is, they're getting that news like that. They have 2 seconds to accept.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's such a good point.
It's impossible. You can't expect someone to accept that fast. It's inhuman. They're going to go through such a process of, well, a lot of them go through bereavement, mm-hmm. the feeling of loss. This human that I've created, that I had visions for, marriage, children, house, happiness, you know, straight wedding, all that sort of stuff, it's gone. You've now got this stranger. Who are you? You know, how could you lie to me? How could you be like this, this awful thing? And it's tough, but sometimes you just got to take it. You got to take the hate and you got to take the offensive things that they're going to say and the stings of the uneducated sort of anger that is in them, and just sort of try and educate them slowly.
And at this time, did you feel like the problem was with yourself, or did you know that this was your dad's problem? Like, did his reaction, did it make you feel like it was your fault?
No. I was completely in the right. As any teenager, I was like, oh my God, so annoying. Like, get over it. You know, that I was still just a normal teenager. I just had this heavy, heavy burden on my shoulders. And actually, what you'll find is, speaking to a lot of LGBT teenagers, you know, they might be 15, but actually mentally they're about 20, because they've been forced to learn social psychology just by default, by existing in the world that they live in. They're incredibly woke with it, intelligent. They spot bullshit a mile off. And it's one of the reasons why a lot of LGBT people end up in high powered roles. Once they've come out, they're CEOs, they're executives, they're TV presenters, they're, you know, they're master communicators or master entertainers, because they've had their training for all those years while trying to disguise who they are, while trying to teach people who they are eventually. And then when they're out, it's amazing.
And when you told your dad and your mum, then did you go on to tell other people? Like, did your dad tell his family, and was that the end of it?
So my dad spoke to my family, part of my dad's family that live in Ireland, and the reaction was awful, really awful. And we don't really speak to them anymore as a result. As a family, we've kind of become estranged. Because I won't say exactly which family member, but on my dad's side, one of them suggested that, you know, to get Riyad better, we need to send him to Syria to a conversion camp, and then we'll find him a wife, you know, an arranged marriage. Yeah. And thankfully, that sort of suggestion came at a point where my dad had learned to put his love above his shame and to accept his, you know, beautiful gay son. And he said to, you know, that person in the family, you're not part of my family anymore. We don't need you. He couldn't imagine that, you know, such a suggestion would be made. And that's because inherently, even though my dad at one point was uneducated and afraid, deep, deep down, what you have there is a good person. And you can't remove a good person. You can't just delete that from, you know, his psyche. He is warm, affectionate, kind. He cries at anything on the telly, you know. He's a real softy. He's a big, big softy.
So this almost allowed him to let his guard down.
Yeah, well, we always say that me coming out has been the best thing ever for our family. It's brought us closer together, and it's allowed us to talk about anything. Well, you know all about our family. We celebrate love and passion and sex. And sometimes mom will go a little bit too far, and she'll tell me bits of my body bits of my father's body that she loves. And I'm like, whoa. I don't need to know about that.
You're an incredibly open family and loving and best friends. And I think so many people admire you guys. With your dad, even seeing him on the Late Late Show, and it's almost like he's painted as a villain in a way. Was it a decision that you guys were so incredibly honest about his reaction? And it seems like he kind of came around and was amazing, like, quickly. So what I'm trying to say is,
I know what you're trying
to say. You could have covered that up. You could have covered his reaction up. Why didn't you?
Well, we as a family, but mainly him, when he finally came around and decided to be this, you know, amazing supportive father of a gay son, he knew the power that his story had in altering other parents' perceptions of their gay kids. So if he can be a living, breathing example of what a journey you can go on to accept, then he's happy to do it. And that's why I love that man so much. He's, you know, he is a saint. You know, he is. I can't tell you how many lives have been saved because of my dad and his story and his openness to tell his story.
He's amazing.
He gets DMs all the time. My mom does. I do. From parents around the world who have seen this video and have had a kind of an aha moment, kind of where they go, right, I get it. This is not the right reaction to have. I need to embrace this child because they're in a vulnerable state and they need me now more than ever. And he's okay to tell the story because what I always say in interviews or when I'm talking to friends is that that wasn't my dad. That was someone else. He was possessed by the social conditioning that was put in him from a life growing up, you know, in Iraq and a culture that had told him that this was wrong. That isn't him. So I don't judge him, and I make sure that he doesn't feel any guilt at all. Because if anything, Georgie, he has paid back in spade loads to me and the community as a whole, way more than, you know, what happened that night.
And he's done so much for you guys. And he your dad and your mom wrote a chapter in your new book, Yay, You're Gay Now What? Which has to win some sort of award for the best book title in the world.
It's just out there, isn't it?
Number one bestseller. Obviously, you were going to write a book someday, but I just think the concept of it is so genius. Tell us a little bit about it.
So I had planned to maybe write a book years down the line. I had so many other things I wanted to do, and I thought, if I write a book now, no one's going to buy it. No one knows who I am. No one cares. But the publisher came to me and they said, look, they had seen a show I did on BBC called Queer Britain. There were documentaries about LGBT life. And they said, we think that you're the right guy to write this book. And I kind of knew in my head that if I don't take this, someone else is going to do it. And if there's one thing that I can write a book about, it's this. There's not many things that I'm an expert on, but I really am in this, you know. And I had gotten all through the years through my YouTube channel and all the social media stuff I've done, I had all of these thousands, like literally thousands of messages from young LGBT people around the world going, I'm having suicidal thoughts. I'm self-harming. I don't know how to come out. I've got bullies in school. My teachers aren't accepting me. The list goes on and on and on. And I thought, right, this is going to be the Bible. This is going to be the guide that no matter what you're going through, there's a page in here for it. There's a chapter in here for it. And I wanted it to not just be the Riyadh show, if you will, where it's all just me telling you stuff. I had my followers, all of these beautiful LGBT boys, teens and men, submit their stories of triumph and success and getting over adversity. To show that even if you're in a region where it's really dangerous, even if you've got parents that have kicked you out, even if you've got a, you know, a homophobic boss, you can still have whatever you want if you follow these steps. So, it's been a journey. And, you know, when I started writing the book, I thought, this is great. Oh my God, I could do with all of this information if I was still 15. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. But there was this big gaping hole in the narrative. And that was, what do I say to parents, teachers and bullies? And I decided to get my parents in to do the chapter that they did, which is kind of specifically aimed at the non-LGBT person. Here's how you can support them. And here's how you can support yourself. You're going through a really big transition trying to accept this person who's just come out to you. That's okay. It's okay to feel a bit weird. It's okay to feel a bit shameful, but it can't last forever.
And Stephen Fry wrote a piece for this book.
That was hilarious.
When did you, what was the moment like when you found out that was happening?
Well, I was asked to go to New York to the UN to interview Stephen and Richard Curtis. Richard's the guy who wrote Bridget Jones. And so I was freaking out. I did the interview, and then I knew that my mission was to get Stephen to do this section in the book. And I was going to befriend him during the interview. Do the, you know, the Irish, charmy, charmy, winky, winky, I'm your leprechaun mate kind of thing. You know what we do? You know, we could get everything we want with the, Jesus, no way, you know. And he was leaving. Thank you very much for the interview and his PR. And, you know, there's always a girl there on the side with a clipboard looking mean.
Yeah.
And I basically, I had the death grip on his elbow and I just said, Stephen, before you go, I had like white knuckles.
This is ballsy.
I know. And there was a lot of security in the room. By the way, I'm thinking 20 second pitch, go. I'm writing this book and it's specifically for young LGBT boys who are trying to come out into the world. It's sort of a life Bible, and it's been approved by, you know, Stonewall and all. I listed loads of organizations he would know, just so we knew that it wasn't going to be damaging. I said, I'm looking for influential gay men who can write a section in the book, which is sort of a note to their younger self. I'd love if you could. Is there someone I can contact in your team? And he goes, yeah, here's the email to Sue or whatever her name was. And I wrote to her about 20 minutes later. And it wasn't even a full day had passed. And I had the the bit written for my book.
Wow.
And permission and best wishes and a headshot.
Oh my God.
And well, like, can I read the bit?
Yes, please.
Because I've done like a few interviews for the book, but they're never as fun as this one, Georgie.
Oh, thank you.
And they're never as chill. And I've always wanted to kind of get it out there because it just made me cry when I read it. It's so poignant. So this is Stephen Fry's message to his younger self. He says, "Stephen, it's going to be fine. The world will change for the better. It'll be achingly slow, but the light will break through the clouds, I promise. Live an honest, open life, and people won't despise you for it. Or if they do, they won't be worth knowing. Only insecure and unhappy people snigger and sneer. One day, you won't believe this now, but one day, you'll even be able to marry another man, and it will seem like the easiest and most natural thing in the world. The only story is that there will be no story. Just wait, the tide will turn."
Wow.
Isn't that incredible?
Wow.
Look,
and
I got goosebumps.
You had that a day later?
Not even, like 16 hours later, something like that.
Oh my God, beautiful words.
Unbelievable. And then also in the book, we've got Dr. Ranch from Strictly Come Dancing and Courtney Act and a couple of Hollywood-y people and a few artists, you know, painters. And because I wanted to get across that, like I said at the start, this thing that you have inside of you doesn't mean that you can or can't do anything. You know, there's no limitations on you, right? Because you believe that you must be the stereotypical gay man. No, there is no such thing. Mm. There is no such thing. You design your life. Go and do it. And as Oscar Wilde says, one of my favorite quotes ever, he's like, don't try to be anyone else because they're already taken.
That's amazing.
You know?
When we sat beside each other in work and the marriage referendum was coming up and we had a staff meeting one morning and you said, if this doesn't pass, I'm going to leave the country.
Mm.
And we said,
I was like, so I'm just letting you know, bosses, yeah, find a replacement.
But you were deadly serious.
Do you know why? Because I was angry. I want to use the F word. I won't. I was effing angry that my future, my life, my friends' lives were being decided upon by people that had no straight person. I'm sorry to say this, but no straight person should have a say on whether I have freedoms and rights. It's not okay. And our boss, Shona Ryan, pulled me in the day of the vote and I was panicking. I was trying to get all my work done. She pulled me into her office and I thought, oh my God, don't fire me on the gay day. That's homophobic. Don't do that, hon. I'll be talking about you on the news. And she pulled me into her office and she had tears in her eyes. And she just stood there and she just said, I am so sorry. I am so sorry that I have a say in your future.
Oh my God.
And I was like, wow. And it was the first time that I had had a second to stop and think and go, wow. Yeah, you do. Like, if you wanted to, you could just say, nah, I don't want them to have you know, equality and rights and happiness and protections. That's the main thing, protections. Can you imagine my darling, beautiful boyfriend, Josh, who I will no doubt marry down the line, if we didn't have that ability to form that civil, you know, marriage, and he was on his deathbed, rushed into hospital while I was in work, and I'm rushing into hospital to be by his side and say goodbye to him, and the nurse by law had to say, I'm sorry, you're not a legal partner, we can't let you into the room.
Jesus.
That happens. That still happens. You know what I mean? Not here,
mm-hmm,
in Ireland, and of course in the States they've legalized it, but in the past there are countless LGBT partners who didn't get to say goodbye and then who didn't get to go to the funeral because the family didn't accept.
What was it like when David Norris was up there?
Oh my God, thank you for bringing that up. If you don't know, David Norris is basically like the Irish Harvey Milk. He is this freedom fighter. In 1993, homosexuality was decriminalised in Ireland. So I was 2 years old and it was still illegal to have gay sex.
Wow.
Mad. And he took, this is just incredible, him, in partnership with Mary Robinson, former President of Ireland, took Ireland to the European Court of Human Rights to say that this is a breach. And the case was called Norris versus Ireland. Like, I'm getting emotional just talking about it. Like, isn't that amazing? And he won. It's just beautiful. And the day of the vote, I just saw this old, fabulous, powerful, inspiring man get on stage. The vote had just come through. Everyone was crying. And there was no microphone for him for whatever reason. They just couldn't get one there on time. And he said, what did he say? He goes, I've got quite a well-carrying voice. And we're all howling, laughing, because, yeah, we know, David, come on, okay. And he goes, the message that's sent out into the world from this small, independent republic is one of dignity, freedom, and tolerance. Liberté, égalité, fraternité. And the whole crowd, thousands and thousands of people, even the ones that couldn't get into Dublin Castle, just erupted in cheer. And we're bawling our eyes out, my family and I, that have come on this long journey together, campaigning since I was 17 years old. You know, this is like a decade later. And finally, our beautiful country has said, yes, we believe that you deserve these rights. And I remember we walked out onto Dame Street and the city had shut down. All of the cars had stopped. Dublin buses were tooting their horns. Fire brigades were blaring their horns. People were kissing and dancing and playing music. And it was just like, this is a day that will go down in the history books. Kids will be learning about this day forever. It was almost like a Martin Luther King moment when he stood up there and gave that speech. And I'm so, so proud that, you know, I got to be part of that in a very, very small way.
I'll never forget that day. I woke up and I was just thinking of like all my gay friends, like yourself, Brendan, Paul Banas. Like I was just bawling for the whole day because I was just so happy. What was it when you woke up the next day? Were you looking around at the country differently?
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
So you hit the nail on the head. It was like I grew up. It was like I woke up in a different country.
Mm.
I felt so free. I was like, I can be as gay as I want now. Do you know what I mean? You spend so many years suppressing and editing and censoring yourself. It's like, I'm just going to be a one-man pride parade. You know, let's go. And but I did feel like walking through Dublin City Centre or, you know, Bray Main Street, where I'm from, that, you know, you love me.
Did you feel safer?
I felt safer. Yes, exactly. I felt like, there's no way that anything's going to happen. And even if someone tries something, I know that there's 60 odd percent of the population are here to support me and they'll stop it.
So we voted yes. And then you still left the country.
Sorry.
I want to talk a little bit about moving away from home, because so many people who listen to this podcast send me messages and they're like, I'm walking on the beach in Sydney, or I'm sitting at my desk in Dubai. Or
I still listen to Irish radio and podcasts in London because of that.
Why? Because it gives you a sense of home?
Sense of home, comfort. It can make me upset as well when I feel like I'm out of the loop. You know, London is an incredible city and it's given me so many gifts and so many opportunities. It's given me my partner. But I miss the crack. I miss the camaraderie. I miss that I can walk down the street and talk to any stranger and we know each other in 2 minutes. And we realize that we know 20 of the same people and we're probably related. Do you know what I mean? And I love I know that this is probably not a good thing to say, but I love the harmless bitching.
Mm.
Jesus, stay to him. Oh, how are you doing? You okay? Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think there should be a limit on it, but it's just a part of the fibre of who we are.
Was it hard for you to make the decision to go?
No. No, not really. I had kind of felt like in my job I had plateaued. I there was nothing more that I could learn and my dream wasn't being fulfilled. I really, really wanted to be, you know, an on-air presenter, radio, TV, whatever it was, with my own show. And I felt that I had the skills, I had the learning, I had the talent, but I felt there were blocks in my way. And I tried it with our state broadcaster. I tried it with, you know, the group that we worked in with various stations. And I think I was sort of seen as more of a, you know, You're really the curse is, right, here's the curse: when you're really good at a job that you don't necessarily want to do anymore, it's hard to leave because you're just the guy who does that thing and you do it quite well.
Yeah.
And I felt like, well, maybe I should just stop doing it very well. And I think you might actually, we've never spoken about this, but you might remember nearing the end, I kind of just took
stopped the, working.
Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed.
I took the foot off the gas. And you were like, Riyadh, like, you've done two articles in a day. Like, what's wrong? And I'm like, oh, just really busy. Like, it's just there. Like, I really wanted to make sure the research was right. And I was called away to this. I was just making up stuff because I was like, do you know what?
Your heart wasn't in it.
No, I was done. I checked out mentally, but still loved the building, the people and the brand. So I had this opportunity to go to the UK and to work in the world's biggest news website and earn like three times the money. And I thought, how could I not? And I didn't really agree with their morals and their ethics, but I thought I'll go in like a Trojan horse and I'll change them.
Mm.
3 months in, nothing changed and I had to leave. Honestly, 3 months, that's as long as I lasted. And thankfully at the time I had a YouTube channel that had about 150,000 subscribers and I thought I can probably just about skim by with the money that I'm making from this channel. I was nowhere near comfortable. I was living on the edge for quite a while, but it was the best decision I ever did because it allowed me to write TV pitches, to go for schmoozy coffees and you know, lick arse and try and get the dream gig. And eventually I got the call.
Sometimes you just need a bit of space,
headspace,
to figure things out.
What do I really want?
Your life is, well, you've always been really healthy, but you live your life in such a great way, I think, because you really listen to yourself. You're always like wiser than your years. Tell us a little bit about your diet and your healthy habits, because, well, I remember in Spin you used to eat like broccoli for your breakfast.
Yeah.
You were always really into clean eating and you look really well and healthy.
Oh,
and
thanks. It's all an illusion. Good light. I don't know where or how or why I got fascinated in healthy eating and wellness, both physically and mentally. But I think it comes from living in your own head for such a long time and not necessarily speaking to a lot of people. You just sort of, my family are quite healthy, but they're by no means where I am, you know, with sort of how strict I can be on myself. I've got IBS and that started when I was about 17, 18. And I just thought I was eating too much. I thought I was overweight, but really it was just my inflamed guts pushing. You know what I mean? It was just my intestines going, ah, stop putting that crap inside your body. It was dairy. So I was kind of forced to look at my diet. So I guess my healthy habits are, you know, every morning I wake up and I have a big tablespoon or 2 tablespoons of apple cider vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
They say it's good for your digestion and it clears out your lymphatic system. And then I have my own concoction, which is I sort of call it my gut smoothie.
Okay.
So it's a full lemon squeezed with all the pith, all the fiber in. Then I put in a big heaped teaspoon of spirulina powder with wheatgrass. And I think there's Coralia in it. I think that's what it's called. And then I'll also have a big teaspoon of psyllium husk. Which is, have you ever heard of psyllium husk?
No.
So it's amazing. It's like a sweeping brush for your bowel.
Okay.
So it's a powder that expands in water and it grabs all of the particles of food and feces, let's just call it a spade, and pulls it out of your body. So when you've got a gut issue like me with IBS and you've got irregular movements and you don't know what kind of, sorry about this, consistency you're going to get, it kind of gives you a bit of regularity and your eyes are brighter and you're less bloated. It's amazing.
Wow.
And I mix them all up in a protein shaker and I just knock it back. And anyone who's sort of gone, what is that green monstrosity you're drinking? I always give them a sip and they can't even get that down.
Okay, right. So I'm going to put that in an Instagram post. And what does your me time look like if you're having a bad day, like you say, with your anxiety? Like, what do you do to mind yourself?
I check out, you know, I close the emails. I tell the team I'm just not available today. It happens rarely, or I lessen my workload. I'm actually really good now at being kind to myself, because I used to think, oh, if I don't get those emails done, then I won't get that opportunity. And then what's it all for? But now I'm like, no, it's mad when you grow up, you realize these things. It's just, if I don't get back to that commissioning editor in the BBC like that, well, then they're going to want me more. so they can wait because I'm worth waiting for. I am worth the wait. And actually, you're going to get a better product and a better person, a better broadcaster out of me if I'm arriving with the pitch and for this meeting as a calm, happy, content dude, you know? I can't tell you how many meetings I've gone into, you know, midway through a panic attack or at the tail end of one, and I'm just not performing. And and I leave then panicking because I was panicking.
Yeah, and it's just
a vicious
huge
circle.
Yeah.
So, I love a bit of Netflix. I put my feet up and I treat myself to a disgusting meal that I've always gone to, which is my comfort food. I know we've been talking about health food. This isn't very healthy. It's like, you know, instant noodles, mm-hmm. like coconut noodles, ramen noodles, whatever. Chicken flavor, half cooked. So they're still a bit crunchy, mm-hmm. With a little bit of the broth still in. And then a tin of mackerel. Kind of shredded into the noodles, and then the fried eggs that chopped up roughly mixed in, and loads of black pepper, and if you're really feeling fancy, a big dollop of mayonnaise on the side.
Oh, Rhea, that's gross.
It's so
good. Does anyone else eat this with you?
I know no one I've ever met has ever said that they like it, and it's I shouldn't like it because it's eggy and fishy and chickeny. It's so bad. It's so bad, but it's so good. It's warm. And it's one of those things that you finish it and you're full, but my God, you could have six of them.
You go to bed every night under a picture of Oprah.
Yes. She's actually now moved to the living room.
I really need to.
That's my boss.
Okay.
My boss. My boss, like Josh. That came out by accident. My boyfriend.
Blink twice if you need help.
Wow. That's a Freudian slip. He is the boss of the house though.
Okay. You've moved Oprah under his rules. You've moved Oprah to the lounge.
Yes.
And what's his problem with Oprah?
Well, we just feel, I got him a Beyonce picture for his birthday. So we thought our two queens need to be in the communal space.
Okay.
And the bedroom is going to be something else.
You are amazing. You're on BBC. You've got your own podcast. What's it called?
Unexpected Fluids. So I just have to put a prerequisite out there. It's quite dirty. It's about sexual fails, but it's hilarious. We're almost into our fourth season now.
So. That's incredible. So your podcast on the BBC, obviously your YouTube is going strong and you've got lots more up your sleeve. Your book, Yay, You're Gay, Now What, is a number one bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations. Thank you. So proud of you. And I think that we should probably leave for the day that's in it on your favourite Oprah quote because, yeah. I mean, it would be rude not to.
I think so. And she's probably listening. I do. I hear she's a fan of the pod. I do.
Thanks.
Yeah. Queen O, listen up. Create the highest, grandest vision for your life because you become what you believe.
Amazing, Rhea. Thank you so much.
Thank you, darling.
Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast made possible by Sally Hansen. To discover more, you can shop the products in Macaulay Health and Beauty Pharmacies and other stores across the country now. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please subscribe so you can be the first to hear about new ones. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review. To all my listeners in Ireland and those of you around the world, thank you for the amazing support and continued feedback. You can find out more about my story on thegoodglow.ie and follow me on Instagram at georgie.crawford.